Okay, this is sound roll number 32 for Fight in the Fields of Paratime Production. We have a minus 8 dB reference tone to follow on the modulometer, which equals 0 VU. Okay, it's now the 26th of July. We're in Fresno. We're going to be doing the interview with Jesse De La Cruz. And so we're starting with take number 1, and I believe that we'll be on camera roll number 68. It'll be 68 unless I tell you differently.
Let's see which one's landing. This is take 1.
Roll in.
Marker.
Interview with Jesse De La Cruz. Jesse, let's start out when you were a young girl growing up here in the Valley. This was during the 1930s. Talk a little bit about what it was like growing up during the Depression, being a farm worker then.
Well, in 1933, we came up north from Watts, and it was terrible. I even hate to think back to it. We lived on tents that didn't have a floor, just dirt, mud, I would say. And we went cold and hungry during winter because there was no work. We survived by going out on the ditch banks and picking mustard greens, and my brothers would go out getting fish from the canals. And we had to wait until we started working, or rather my brothers found work. And it was very sad. We didn't know what Christmas was. We didn't know what birthday was. We sometimes didn't even have any sweaters. Our blankets were always damp because when it rained, the water would come from get under the tent. And we had to keep our blankets on top of boxes. We had no tables. Our stove and heater was a oil drum that my brothers tore a hole on the side, a square hole, and then a round hole in the back where they put a stove pipe through the lap of the tent. But sometimes we didn't even have any wood to burn. So it was very hard. And then as soon as my brother started working, we were able to get beans and whatever else we needed, but mostly beans and potatoes, as long as we had salt and sugar. And that's what our diet consisted of.
You were telling me that sometimes your brothers...
Are you mumbling?
Yes.
Okay, obviously this is with the air conditioning on.
Come fill the cup, and into the fire, the winter garment of repentance flame.
Did we say speed?
Yes, we did. Summons it.
Okay, this is take 2, marker.
Okay, this is Jesse, take 2. Take 2, we're starting over with the air conditioning on. Jesse, let's actually start the story again, but let's start it when your parents die in Watts and you and your brothers decide to come up to the fields. Tell me that story then.
Yes, we were in Watts at the time, 1930. With the Depression on, we had no food to eat. My grandmother would make menudo, and she would go with my brother house to house selling menudo. And that's how we survived for a few months. And then my brothers, who couldn't find any work, decided to, if we could all come up north, we could go pick fruit or cotton or whatever. So we came up north, about 3 families, and we picked the wrong time because we just caught the tail end of cotton picking, and then winter set in and there was nothing to do, so we lived in Mendota in a tent without a floor, and our clothing and bedding was always wet because there was no floor on the tent, mud inside because the water would seep under the tent. And you had to walk stooped over it because if you touched the canvas on the tent, you would start a leak. So it was very hard. Our stove and heater consisted of an oil drum where my brothers cut a square hole in the front and a round hole in the back, and they put in a stove pipe through one of the flaps in the tent. But it was very hard. With hardly any food, sometimes we had to eat beans without salt because we didn't have any salt. My grandmother would get us together and she'd cry with us because there was nothing to eat. And it's a very sad childhood to look back to. We knew nothing about Christmas, no gifts, no birthdays, nothing, but we were a close family. My grandmother was very loving, and she always talked to us about things that happened and why they had happened, but that did us no good because she did a lot of reading. And she would talk to us about what was happening in Germany and all over, but we didn't understand. We were just little kids. And
you also told me that the story about your brothers not having shoes and crying.
Yes. Actually, he's my brother. He's my uncle. He's my mother's brother, but he's almost my age. And when he was about 8 or 9 years old, he didn't have any shoes, and he would cry. He says, why did you...
Let's start over saying, when my uncle was 8 or 9 years old.
When my uncle was about 8 or 9 years old, he cried because he had no shoes, and he says, why didn't you ever teach me to walk barefooted so I wouldn't need any shoes? But until my grandmother was able to raise a little money to buy him a pair of tennis, he had to go barefooted.
And then finally, when the crops came in and you started working in the field, tell me what it was like working in the fields then.
Well, I was about 13, and we were staying in...
Start over again. I'm sorry.
In Dos Palos at that time.
Start over. I was 13.
I was 13 years old, and we lived in Dos Palos, which is in Fresno County. And we started thinning cotton, or shopping, whatever you call it. And we were paid 10 cents an hour. We would work about 12 hours. And all the money, whatever little money we earned, we turned over to my grandmother, who was in charge of buying the food and all of that. So then my husband at that time, I knew him. He was about the same age as I was, and he was irrigating. He was getting, I think, $2 for 12 hours work. It was miserable pay and a lot of hard work, and not enough to buy food and things that we needed.
Now, around that time, things are tough, and you go out to chop cotton, and you find out that there's a strike. Is this the first time you ever see what a strike is?
No, this happened in, yes, it was...
33.
In 33, see, cotton starts about later than in the valley than it does in Bakersfield. So my two older brothers, decided we should go out to Bakersfield and pick a little cotton before it started out here. So we went out there, and we were out picking cotton when we saw all these cars and trucks just honking and calling, strike, strike. So we walked out, and we just followed the caravan. I didn't know anything about a strike. So we just followed the caravan. And then my brother said, well, we might as well go back home. And we came back to Fireball, to Dos Palos, out there with my grandmother, who had been left behind with the younger children. And
during that period, when you went out and when you were in the fields and when you met the people in the strike, who were the people? Were they Anglos or were they Mexicanos? Who was working in the fields?
Mexicanos.
Who were the people
in the strike? Well, they were mixed. Mexicanos and Mexican Americans and Anglos.
I need a complete sentence. You have to tell me the people in the
strike. The people in the strike were Anglos and Mexicans, mostly a few blacks, but hardly any. But there was this big strike, so we just came back home. And out here, we lived isolated. We never had a newspaper or radio or nothing, so we didn't know whether there was a strike, whether the strike had spread out this way or not. We were just kept ignorant. The farmers, they chose to keep us out there so we wouldn't find out anything. Not until I read a book later on, I found out that the big cotton growers and all those sat on the board where they set the price to our work, which was just pennies.
Now, around the middle of the decade, you started seeing some new people coming to California in old cars. Do you remember when the Okies arrived? What that was?
Yes,
like?
Yes. We were working together with them when we lived in...
You can say around
1933, 34. It was 1934. We started picking cotton in Arvin, in the Arvin area, and we lived in this little camp, a tent camp, where we had, I think, about three Anglo-Americans that came in from Oklahoma. They didn't like us. They wouldn't even talk to us. We were all the same age, but they wouldn't talk to us. We were out in the fields picking, doing the same work, and and living under the same conditions, but they thought they were better than we were. They wouldn't talk to us.
And then more and more came, right?
Yes, and there were so many of them that we got paid less than we had been paid before. So that made it harder. And they lived the same way we did, but I don't know why they felt that they were better.
The other thing that happened in the middle of the decade was that that they started forcing Mexicans to go back to Mexico. Did you know people who were deported?
Yes.
I'm sorry, we're off? Okay. I'm sorry. Are you still on?
Yeah.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about that.
Yes, I know many families who went back to Mexico. They were deported. Well, they were volunteered. They asked, do you want to go back to Mexico? Of course, they were forced to go because there was no work and they were hungry. So we knew we had many friends who went to Mexico. But then later, their children grew up and they came back. They were American citizens, and lots of them still live here.
Did you know people who came back as braceros too?
Yes. Not the citizens from here, but I knew the braceros. We lived in Cantua Creek, which is around the Tranquility area here in Fresno County. And there were braceros out there in the camp, and they were mistreated. They were worked hard, and if they complained, we talked to some of them, because we lived in the same labor camp. They would tell us they were ill, their stomach was upset or something, and yet they still had to go work, because if they complained, they said, okay, you go to work or you go back to Mexico. The labor contractor would tell them this. So they had to go to work. They needed to work. So it was hard, and their food consisted of a stew, a very cheap stew. And for lunch, they would get two slices of bread, put a slice of bologna in the center, sometimes just macaroni or spaghetti between the two slices of bread. And they said, this is no food for us, and they'd throw it away. You know, they wouldn't eat it. And we felt sorry for them. Sometimes we would feed them.
Now, this is jumping way ahead. Are we out of time?
Okay. The last part of the sentence is not in.
That's okay. So we have it on with audio.
Okay, that's the end of camera roll 68. We're now going to 69. Our next take will be take 3.
Is there a room there?
Yep.
And roll in.
Okay, this is take 3. Marker.
Okay, so could we just tell me that beginning, the thing about your mother and your grandmother
mm-hmm.
dying in Watts and then deciding?
Mm-hmm. Yes, my mother and my grandfather died when we lived in Watts, so my grandmother and my older brother were in charge of the family, so they talked it over and they decided it was better for us, since there was no work out there, it was better for us to come up north, pick the crops like prunes, fruit, and the cotton. So that's how we ended up in.
Okay, that's good. Now let's go on. We've talked about the 30s. Did you keep on working in the fields all through the 40s and the 50s, or did you go off and work in defense plants, or did you stay here?
No, I worked the fields all my life.
But then towards the end of the 1950s and into the 60s, something new starts happening. When did you first hear that there might be a chance to make things better for farm workers?
Uh-huh. Well, as a child, I always thought if there was somebody who would help, you know. There were strikes, but they were what we call huelgas locas, because there was no leadership. But then in 1962, I believe, we started talking about a union for farm workers, and that's when Cesar and two other men came to our house in Parlier, and they started talking to my husband about joining the union. So we became members. I became a member on May the 1st of 1962 for a United Farm Workers Organizing Committee. Then about 2 years later, I was made an organizer. And but before that, I had been out in the fields talking to people about, you know, people that had been, that were working with me. I would talk to them about the union. I was an organizer, but I would talk to them about the union and that it would be good for farm workers because we needed representation. And so I was organizing by that time. So later I was made an organizer, so then I did go on speaking, you know, to groups.
Well, when you first met Cesar and this idea surfaced, I know you'd always thought it was possible, but could you tell right then that it would work, that this was a guy who could make it? Were you optimistic or pessimistic?
Just so the net fell off.
Oh, the net fell off.
Okay, that was take three. Take four will be next.
We'll have some take four, marker.
So, that first night in Parlier when Caesar and some other people came to the house, what were your impressions of Caesar? How did he strike you?
He sounded very sincere.
Start out by saying, when
Caesar came, Chavez.
Hang up, take a pause and say, when Caesar came that night.
Yes, when Caesar came that night to our house in Parlier, he talked to us about forming a union for farm workers. He sounded very sincere, and when we asked questions of him, he looked you right in the face and told you. He didn't just, no. We got direct answers, and I felt that that was a good future for farm workers.
Did Fred Ross come to that first meeting, do you remember?
And not the first one.
Did you meet Fred?
Yes, he used to come to my house in Parlier when we had house meetings, or when I had meetings at my house and people would come, and we had Fred Ross come in.
What did you think about this guy who was obviously not a farm worker, he was an Anglo?
We needed all kinds of help. So to us, he was fantastic because he told us how to go about doing things without getting arrested. And
So then you start having house meetings.
Yes.
And learning how to organize.
Mm-hmm, yes. The AFL-CIO sent a man to teach us how to organize from New York. And he was with us out there, and we would sit down and have meetings with him. And that's how I learned to organize. And it sounded very good to me because we'd never had anything like that for farm workers. And I felt that for the first time, there was good news for farm workers.
Did you think it was going to be easy, though?
Of course, I didn't think it was going to be easy because I'd been through it before. And we would talk to people. Some would respond. Others would say, oh, you're crazy. We're going back to Mexico, and we don't care what happens to you after we leave. But then I would point out, you know, when you come back, you'll have better working conditions and higher wages. And so I did get a lot of them to come to the meetings. Some of the men wouldn't bring their wives. They said, oh, she had to stay home and take care of the children. And I said, well, who took care of the children while they were working out during the day? I said, besides, you can bring the children to the meetings. And many of those children that were little at that time, they're grown up and they're working, they're helping the union.
Mm-hmm. Now, apart from people being skeptical and thinking it wouldn't work, did you get the sense that a lot of farm workers were afraid, that they felt weak?
Yes, they were afraid. They would say, no, if I have a meeting at my house is going to be bombed. And I said, it won't. Mine hasn't been bombed. I said, and I'm having meetings out here all the time, so don't be scared. That's one of the things that is against us, being scared. You have to come out and be brave and fight for what you believe in and for your rights.
Did anyone tell you, well, you shouldn't listen to Caesar because they're communists and they're outsiders and they don't know we know what's best for you, listen to us?
No, as a matter of fact, lately, not too long ago, I heard about Caesar being, they were watching him to see if he was involved with the communist. And I recall one time when I had the hiring hall in Parlier, three Anglos came to the office, and they started asking me about the union. And they asked me, well, what does Cesar Chavez tell you to do? I said, well, he tells us to tell the people the truth, not to lie to them. Tell them the truth and to organize them into the union. And he talks to us about a better future for us. And that's all they got out of me because I don't even know what it takes to be a communist.
Who do you think those people were?
I don't know. It set me to thinking maybe it was somebody that was trying to get, you know, mm-hmm. something on us. Mm-hmm. Like when we first started organizing workers, we couldn't organize those that were not legally here because we knew, or Cesar told us, you know, the growers, the farmers, they're just waiting for just one little thing against us to go after the union. So for the time being, we're not going to make members of those that don't have any papers. For a time, we didn't. But then we kept thinking, well, the government allows to come them out here. The grower wants them out here. So why shouldn't they be represented by a union? So that's when we started at a meeting, a big meeting in Delano. It was voted on that, yes, we would organize those that we wouldn't ask if they were legally here or not.
So tell me a little bit about 1965. Now, you started doing house meetings and you became an organizer. What did you think would happen when the grape strike started? How did that strike you?
Well, for us, it was very good. Because, see, before that, we had been working, picking grapes, wine grapes on gondolas, and we would fill them all the way to the top. And they're pulled by a tractor throughout your rough ground. So by the time they got to where they were dumped, they said, half a ton. We knew there was over a ton of grapes in that gondola. Or it would be 2 tons, and I'd say 1.5 tons. So then that's why when we had our union contract in Ridley, our first contract there, we asked for a scale. And that is how we found out how much money had been taken from us through this process of, you know, where the grapes settled down and the labor contractor would tell us. When it was two tons, he'd say 1.5 tons.
But see, I want to talk about 1965. You're here in Fresno working in the grapes, and you become a member. And then the strike starts in Delano. Did people hope the strike would come here? Well, how did they think about what was happening?
Yes, we wanted that here, around here, because we needed it. But all of us would go out there to Delano and help the strikers out there, not only with being out on the picket lines, but by donating food and clothing for those strikers that were not working. So that's how the union has been able to survive, through donations. Because if it had been just us, the farm workers, we wouldn't have made it. So I still say, if it hadn't been for people out in the cities, we wouldn't have made it, not on our own.
Well, see, the growers would say, well, we're signing because of the boycott, but that's because they're putting pressure on us, and you don't, the farm workers don't really want to join the union. You're forcing them to join the union.
Of course, they would say that. Same thing as they might say, we don't need higher wages, but we do. Put them on our shoes, and they'll know if we need a union or not.
Now tell me a little bit about getting the first contract and setting up. Oh, let's stop and change it.
Okay, that's the end of camera roll 69 and the end of the sound roll. That was take 4.
Should I go comment?
No, it's okay. Let's repeat. This is sound roll 33. Here we go. Here comes Tom. Okay, we're starting camera roll 70. Our next take will be take 5. We're continuing the interview with Jesse De La Cruz.
Ay, está bien así.
¿Cómo
para acá?
You were just perfect.
Now you see?
Awesome. Okay, good. Okay, he's still speeding. Okay, let's go.
Okay, this is take 5. Marker.
So the Delano strike started in 1965, and the strike is really known focusing on table grapes, but there were wine companies, and one of the first targets was Christian Brothers, and that was where you were working, right?
Yes.
So tell me about how the process worked at Christian Brothers, working.
Well, we didn't even have to strike. We just got all the people together.
Again, I was working. Take a deep breath and then say, I was working.
I was in the hiring hall. I was not working. And people started talking about their going out to picket or strike Christian Brothers. And so we got the people together. And we decided it would be around 3 o'clock in the morning where we would go out there to the entrance and try to stop as many people as we could. But then we didn't have to go through all of that. We had groups that were making coffee, that were making food, everything for during the day for the strikers, but we didn't have to go through that. We got a the strike was off. So they negotiated a contract and we got it.
Were you involved in negotiating the contract?
Yes, I went with Dolores Huerta to with the ranch committee to San Francisco to negotiate the contract.
And was that, what did that feel like, sitting down with the bosses and having them listen to you?
Felt good to tell them off what we needed.
Now you got to tell me, felt good to tell the bosses.
Yes, it felt good to tell the bosses off.
Did they give you, I mean, how was it hard to get?
It took us about 3 trips out there before we got the contract, which was very good. It was a very good contract. Everything, all the clauses and everything was voted on, and we got it.
And then what did that feel like to have a contract to be working
on? Oh, it was good. That's the first time I ever worked under a union contract. And I was working at the office, and I had a list of the workers that had been working there before the contract and after the contract, people that registered to work, and we went down the list. We wouldn't pick friends or relatives. We just went down the list and we'd dispatch people out there. But we had a little problem because they would call on a Friday night that they needed maybe 50 workers on Monday. And Saturday and Sunday, you're not going to find the workers at home if they're not working. So I said, why couldn't they let us know ahead of time so I could? So Monday came around and I didn't work the workers. So they complained to Deleno saying that the workers hadn't been sent. So that's when I told him, there's a clause in the contract that says you have to let us know ahead of time at least 72 hours with a letter. And I just received a telephone call asking for these people over the weekend. I couldn't find them. So they knew after that, every time they needed new workers, they would send a letter. And we always had enough workers.
How did that feel, the process of actually running a hiring hall as opposed to going out and organizing? Was it hard to switch gears and adjust?
No, because I had meetings there in the office out in the front yard. And those that were not members would become members then. They heard everything that the union was doing. So they became members. And it wasn't very hard to organize after that. Before that, oh my God, they would call me all kinds of dirty names out in the fields. You know, you should stay home and take care of the kids instead of being out here, they would yell at me. And I said, well, it takes a woman to organize you, so I'm doing it.
Do you think, farm workers, most of them are Mexican, they're fairly traditional people. Was it difficult for them to deal with women who were organizers?
At first it was.
Let's say, again,
Yes, it was. At first it was very hard to organize those that believed that women should stay home and do the washing and the cooking. But they never stopped to think about them working out in the fields. So why shouldn't they attend meetings and be involved with the union? It got to a point to where most of us out in the picket lines were women. Men were working to help support the family, of course, at other places where we were not striking. But then it got to where they recognized women, you know, and gave us a rightful place out in the field.
Now, part of being involved in the union and the strike is getting your family involved. You were telling me that you used to send Malcrialos to Vietnam, to Bobby. Tell me that story.
Yes. When my youngest son, Roberto, was in Vietnam, I was involved with the union. And I would get newspaper clippings and Malcriado, and I'd send copies to him out to Vietnam. And he came home and he told me he was never very interested. You know, he'd pass them on to some of his other boys there or men. And then when he came home, he started going to Fresno City College. And we were picketing in Kingsburg. And they fed him at at the cafeteria, they had this ice cream or something and with a cherry on top. And he doesn't eat sweets. So he just started toying around with it, you know, with his fork, and he broke it open. He says, oh, this is not a cherry. This is a grape. It's just been dyed. So he said, hey, you know, my mom and many of the farm workers were out there under the sun, 110 degrees out there picketing, and we're out here being fed grapes. Let's walk out of the cafeteria. And he got all of them to walk out until they removed the grapes. So that's when he became involved, and he's still at it.
We were just talking about sort of having to overcome barriers as a woman who was out there organizing, but you gained a lot of confidence and you appeared at Senate hearings and you testified. Tell me a little bit about those stories about George Murphy and the things you heard him say.
Yes. Well, we're talking about getting the confidence. Yeah. Well, I had to organize my husband first. Well, of course, he was a union member and he believed in everything the union stood for, and he never told me you can't go here or you can't go there, but I still had to ask him, can I go? It got to a point where I'd leave him a note. I went to so-and-so's house or I went at this meeting and all that. And then I think it was 1968, Senator George Murphy came out to the Delano area, and we knew he was there. We picketed him when he came to Fresno. And I read in the newspaper where he said, it's great for farm workers. They have a picnic atmosphere at noon, at lunchtime, with all the family gathered together, eating their food under the vines. Didn't he see the mud streaking down their faces and all the mosquitoes they had to eat and the dirt and everything? No, of course not, because he was... Well, he had a red carpet by the big growers out there in the best motel, everything. He just came out to the fields and just looked around, and then he came out saying that. Another time he said that stoop labor was good for farm workers because Mexicans were built short, closer to the ground. That's a very racist thing to say, besides a dumb thing to say. I don't see how he made it, Senator.
Part of being close to the ground is the growers would hand you a hoe.
A short handle hoe.
Did you have to use the cookie?
Yes, I did. That's why, among all the work that I did out in the fields, the short handle hoe was the worst. Even right now, I can't sit up straight. I have to sit leaning to one side or at a certain angle so that my back can rest, because the short handle is very bad. I worked at it. And it was banned once. Then they tried to bring it back again, and that's when I testified here in Fresno. We had this big hearing, and they wanted to bring back I took a long handle hoe and a short handle hoe. And then I demonstrated to them how we could work with a long handle hoe and do a good job, and the short handle hoe, how you had to work stooped over for so many hours. And then I asked, those that came in from Washington, I told them, I'm not asking you to go out to the field. Just stand up, hold the tips of your shoes, and walk up and down on this room and see how many times you can do it. And that will give you an idea of what we have to go through out in the fields with the short handle hoe. Well, it didn't come back.
Thank goodness. You were telling me that I don't know when it was, maybe it was this or some other time, but the first time you had to go and make a testimony, a speech, that you were so nervous that you didn't know if you could do it.
Yes, I remember it was for minimum wage for women out here in Fresno, at Fresno High School. There was a hearing, and that was the first time I came as a speaker. And there were all these people from the fast food places and growers and businessmen out there who were opposed to the minimum wage for women. And they said, no, we can't afford it. And I got before them and I told them, how we, at those wages that we were being paid, had to help our husbands in order to feed a family. And so many people had to be on welfare because they didn't earn enough. But if they close, they gave us a living wage, the welfare doors could close forever. And then they started, oh my God, you know, just among themselves. But after that, for 3 days, I had a pain.
Okay, that's the end of camera roll 70, and that was take number 5. We're now going to camera roll 71. Our next take will be take 6.
And they said they couldn't afford a higher wage.
Okay, this is take 6. Marker?
Jesse, you were just talking about testifying about the women, minimum wage for women. And we've been talking about, you know, trying to win contracts from the growers. Why do you think people who run farms were so violently, bitterly opposed to what you were trying to do? Why did they fight you so much?
I think mostly because... I think the growers and those people that hire workers are opposed to a union because, especially the farm worker union, because it's Mexicans. And I've seen so much racism out here that if he had been an Anglo leader, we would have gotten everything. You know, but being Mexicans, the union is composed mostly of Mexican farm workers, American citizens and legal, those that are legal here. And that's why I feel that that is why they fight very hard and bitter against us, and they talk about violence out in the fields. When have you ever heard about a farmer being shot or a farmer being kicked or any of his sons or daughters or anyone in the family being killed? All of them have been farm workers, so where is the violence coming from? From the growers, from their... achichincles, what we call, you know, crew leaders and all that.
Because they really felt very strongly. It was irrational.
Yes. And at first they were not afraid. They would say, oh, these crazy people, they're crazy people. Leave them alone. They're crazy. But then they found out that we were really strong. And when we said something, we stood up to it.
Now, later on, battle shifted, and as well as fighting the growers, you had to fight the Teamsters Union too. And I remember you told me the story about leafleting during campaign when you gave the Teamster the leaflet. Tell me about that story.
When was it? The early 70s or late 60s? I was in San Francisco leafleting and telling people about, you know, the boycott to gather support for the Farm Workers Union, and I went from house to house, and I came to a man that was fixing a big truck out in front in his front yard, and I gave him one of the leaflets, and he says, no, thank you. He says, I'm Teamster. And I said, fine. I said, all unions are good. I said, but the Farm Workers Union need their own union. I said, how would you feel if I came in and tried to be a leader to your union, Teamster Union? I said, I wouldn't know. You would tell me, oh, you know nothing about trucks. And it's the same thing we're saying. Teamsters know nothing about farm work. Besides, they signed with the growers without consulting the farm workers. They signed contracts behind our backs. That's the only way they could do it.
Do you think the Teamsters were sincere about wanting to organize farm workers?
Why hadn't they ever done it before? Until we were organized. That's when they came in because the growers called them in.
And then what happened when you finally got elections?
Well, we lost a few contracts to the Teamsters, and many of the workers tell me that that union is no good. The only thing they do is come out there once in a while to pick up the dues, and that's it. They don't have nobody to complain to, nothing.
Okay, that was take number 6.
Roll in.
Take 7, marker.
Okay, let's just back up and pick up a few other things. Let's go back to 1964. How did you feel when Cesar asked you to become an organizer? Again, say, when Cesar asked
you. Cuando Cesar asked me. Well, no, he didn't ask me. People, the members are the ones that said that I should be an organizer. We had a general organizer out here by the name of Crescencio Mendoza, who passed away a long time ago. And he talked to Cesar about me, how I could relate to people and talk to them the same language they spoke. And so I was made an organizer.
How did you feel about that?
Great. I felt great, like, you know, like I was really part of the movement of La Causa.
Looking back over all the experiences, and it goes back over 30 years, what, apart from what you helped other people do, what did you get out of the experience? How did it change your life?
I felt good about it. It changed being involved with people and talking to people about something good makes me feel good. It makes me that I've done something in this world besides just eat and sleep. And it makes me feel good to be able to help others. I've been involved in many organizations where I always try to help.
You actually, apart from your main involvement with United Farm Workers, you worked with George Ballas on the land.
Yes, since I was an organizer, we started talking, we heard about the 1902 Reclamation Land Act. And we decided, why not going to farming? We've been the farmers all the time, except that we didn't own the land. So we heard about this law that after so many years, those that were getting subsidized water were supposed to sell to small farmers. So we got a large group of people attending our meetings, and then George Ballas came along, and he talked to me about forming an organization which became National Land for People. And I would talk to people about owning the land instead of working for somebody else. And a committee was set up, and I was part of that committee. So they named me one of the people to go talk to one of the big landowners in the Westlands. And we went to his office. We had worked for him for many years. His name was Russell Giffen. He passed away now. And I was the one that was bilingual, so I talked to him about buying some of the access land. And he turned around and he looked at me and he said, "Do you have a $500,000 down payment?" And I said, "My God, Mr. Giffen, the highest you ever paid us was 75 cents an hour. How can we have $500,000 down payment?" You know, so we knew the answer was no. So I went back to the group and I told him what had happened. And so a lot of them became discouraged. I told Mr. Giffen, I said, I feel like I measured your land by the inch because I had the short handle hole working out there and a long handle hole working out in the fields 10 hours a day. And I could say I measured his land by the inch. And yet we didn't get any of that land. But then we got, we still had six families left. And we got together, and we got a loan from an organization here in Fresno, and we rented some land, 6 acres for six families. And we started farming this land, and we, on the second year, we were able to save enough money to give a down payment on our own land, but it was not in the Westlands because we couldn't get any water, any land from the Westlands.
Okay, that was take 7.
Rolling.
Okay, this is take 8, marker.
Jesse, you were just talking to Vicente about what Martin Luther King said. It sort of applies to the Farm Workers Union, too, that Cesar passed on, but he didn't want that to be the end.
Yes, we used to attend all the meetings in Deleno and the ones at La Paz, and every time we had a meeting, Cesar would tell us, he said, "We don't want the same thing to happen to the union as it did to Martin Luther King. After he died, everything went. And I want you to know that when I die, I want this to keep on. You have to be, you know, if the top figure is gone, you move up from staff, you know, move up a step. And those in charge should see to it that the work keeps going on for the union, because he said, if this dies, it means that all the work that I did through all these years was in vain. And we still have that, you know, we have it in our hearts that he said that to us, and this is why we feel so strong about the union. We're not gonna let it die. We're gonna fight for our union as long. I'm old now, and I'll fight to the last.
Because it wasn't just Cesar, it was everybody.
It was everybody. Like people would tell us, Cesar's union. I would say it's not Cesar's union, it's a farm worker union. Cesar is the leader. He tells us, you know, how to go about it, and we get to vote if we agree on it at the conventions. Cesar is not, he doesn't say, you do this. He puts it up to a vote. And it was voted on. So that's how we went about it. And it's still being done.
How did you feel when you heard that he had passed away?
Oh, I felt like part of a member of my family was gone. I'd gotten real close to him and his family, and I knew him quite well, and I just felt bad, because I remember how caring he was about all of us. I remember when my husband passed away, Cesar was there, Dolores was there at the funeral, and they were a big support to me when my husband died. So the union is one big family. And we care for one another.
Thank you. Okay, stop for a second. Just because about it, do we still have time for a single of the black and white picture?
Thanks.
You're welcome.
And room tone.
No,
that's it.
Emilio's turn. He's been
okay, that's the end of the Sad Rolls goodbye.